the increasingly fevered Imad, and longtime Farhadi collaborator Tarena Aladou.
Afternoon. You're tuned into June Afternoon here for Wednesday, the 1st of February, the year 2017. I'm Jeff Brown. I'll be your host for today. We'll find out how the city is looking for volunteers to help them prioritize city programs and services. We'll talk to artist Carmela Anderson about her solo show at the Alaska State Museum. Steve Brockman will be here with a preview of his wildlife visitation program tonight. We'll also get an update on all things Girl Scouts with guest Sue Perls. And we'll get an update from Eagle Crest, that writer's almanac, Burnout Music Award today on June Afternoon. Well, the forecast for tonight, mostly cloudy skies with low temperatures around 15 degrees with light winds. Forecast for Thursday, mostly clear skies with high temperatures around 30. Thursday night, clear skies, low temperatures around 20.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Standing Rock Sioux Tribe says it will challenge any suspension of the Dakota Access Pipeline's environmental review. In a press release Tuesday night, the tribe states it's ready to pursue legal action. The statement was made after two North Dakota U.S. lawmakers issued statements saying they were notified by the White House and the Department of Army that the agency will be granting the final easement for the project. The tribe says it has not received formal notice and stands ready to fight in court. The environmental impact study started in January. Shortly after inauguration, the Trump administration moved to expedite the project. Tribal leaders and environmental groups say the pipeline project needs to follow the legal process, which includes the completion of the study. Meanwhile, people opposing the pipeline continue to camp near construction in North Dakota. Joy Braun is with the Indigenous Environmental Network and says efforts will continue to stop the pipeline despite actions by the Trump administration.
At least until the comment period is done, which is February 20th. To continue doing what we do here, which is raise awareness and continue to pray and plan nonviolent action, should that be needed. That's kind of what was going on yesterday. Right now, there is a fire walk going on the water itself, up on the Missouri River.
Cleanup is underway at the main camp. People have been asked to leave by the tribe due to spring flooding. Braun says they're working with the tribe on cleanup efforts while people are moving to other camping areas.
We are moving people out of Ospeki. Come prepared to work. We need help. We need a lot of help. The easement could be granted in days. We don't know. So if you come, be prepared, just as we have always said, for the elements. Be prepared, you know, physically, emotionally, psychologically. You know, things could happen.
Those opposing the project say it threatens water and the environment, while supporters say it's safe and will enhance American energy. The Standing Rock Sioux Tribe continues to receive support nationwide in its effort to protect the land and water. A group of people took to the streets in Anchorage, Alaska recently to demonstrate against attempts by the Trump administration to fast-track development of the Dakota Access Pipeline and the Keystone XL Pipeline. Alaska Native activists say their efforts are just the beginning. Daisha Eaton has more.
Both Native and non-Native demonstrators held signs and a large banner reading, "Water is life and people over profits." Faith Gemmel Gwichin Athabaskan from Arctic Village, who's the executive director of Red Oil, resisting environmental destruction on indigenous lands, said their intention was to show solidarity.
We came together because here in Alaska, our indigenous peoples and our communities are also under threat with the same insane energy proposals that target our homelands, places that are critical to our subsistence way of life, our food security.
Dune Lankard, who is the Alaska representative for the Center for Biological Diversity, said tribes need to stand up for their rights in the current political climate.
I'm here to support the Native Americans who are standing up against oil and gas drilling across America. And as you can see, there's a lot of non-Native people who feel the same way, that we have to stand up for our rights because they're being eroded daily, especially with this new administration.
The coalition hopes to expand in the coming weeks to include other groups who feel negatively impacted and to hold more demonstrations. In Anchorage, I'm Daisha Eaton.
U.S. Montana Congressman Ryan Zinke is closer to becoming the Secretary of the Interior Department after his nomination passed a Senate committee Tuesday. Some tribal leaders in Montana are in support of Zinke leading the agency, which oversees Indian affairs. Rick Perry's nomination for Energy Department Secretary also passed the committee. The former Texas governor has reportedly resigned from the board of Energy Transfer Partners, the company behind the Dakota Access Pipeline. Both nominations head to the full Senate. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation.
Support for this program is provided by the Native American Rights Fund, reminding you that sovereignty is not free. Native American Rights Fund has been helping Indian tribes for over 40 years with critical issues such as treaty enforcement, hunting and fishing rights, Indian child welfare, religious freedom, and more. You too can become a modern-day warrior with your support for NARF's work. Learn more at narf.org and join the fight for Native rights.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
It's about 6 minutes past the hour. You're tuned into Juno Afternoon. My next guest, my first guest, is Bob Bartholomew, who runs the money part of the CBJ. Bob, thank you for coming down.
You're welcome.
So you're here to talk about the budget and looking for volunteers.
Right. Looking at a new process that we're starting to work on this year.
How much money are we talking about when we talk about the city budget?
So the city budget as a whole, and all-inclusive of our business enterprise funds, is about $330 million. So if we count the school district and the hospital and our capital projects, it's about $330 million. If you talk about how much of that is general government, how much of it is funded by our property and sales taxes, it's about $100 million.
And you're trying to find out, using volunteers, what's important about city services?
Right. And so what we're doing this year is we're going through a process to try and prioritize, first off, inventory all the programs and services so we can communicate that out to the assembly and to the citizens. And then we're looking to have feedback on how do we value those? Which ones do we value more than others? Of course, people support them all. That's why we've been doing them, but we may not always be able to provide it all.
Is this unique?
No.
You're asking for volunteers to give you their 2 cents.
Right. And so what we're going to be asking for volunteers on is we've gone through the first round of inventorying and prioritizing our programs and services and how we did that. Well, first off, is it unique? No, it's kind of a best practices act that lots of communities and businesses have gone through to first inventory all the programs and services and then rank them on which ones we think are the most valuable. And, of course, there's a lot of varied opinions, so that's why we need community feedback. Is we've gone through, we've done our first run at trying to rank them and talk about what's most important. And you see things like providing clean drinking water, having police respond when there's an emergency. Those obviously are your high priorities, and that doesn't really surprise people. But when you start to talk about other items like the museum or street cleaning, they're important, but they're not as important.
What's the process?
So the process, where we're at in the process now is we've gone through the first part of inventorying them. The assembly identified, based on their knowledge of the community, some priorities, because to be able to evaluate or to score programs and services, you need to measure that against something. And so the assembly identified 4 categories of priorities, and those categories are quality, family-oriented community, reliable, well-maintained infrastructure, a safe community, and then a vibrant local economy. So those are the criteria that we use to measure our programs and services against. So we've done the first round of that. We've used those priorities, and we've created an inventory, and we've started a web page on the city's website for providing this information to the public. And now we're kind of ready for the next phase.
You have a series of 5 meetings.
Right. There'll be actually a total of 7 public meetings, But we have five specific ones now where we're looking for volunteers to come in and help us work on this.
And how are the meetings divided?
Okay, and those, the groups that we're looking for are senior citizens, and that's the one we're working the hardest on right now because we're asking them to be available for a two-hour focus group session. So each of these volunteers that we're looking for, we're asking them to commit to a two-hour meeting. So for the senior citizens, it would be this Friday at 10 a.m., and you go to www.juno.org, and you can there'll be a link there for how do you volunteer for the senior citizen group. The next group is going to consist of Rotary and Chamber of Commerce members, and that's next Monday. There's a general public session on Thursday, February 9th, 1 to 3 p.m. We want a families with kids session, and that's for families with children that are from kindergarten through eighth grade, and that's going to be Saturday, February 11th. And then we'll have another general public session on Thursday, February 16th, from 6 to 8 p.m. And again, all those are on the website. And if you fit into any of those groups, which everybody fits into the general public group, and we're looking for 12 to 16 volunteers, so it's not a lot, but it's always a push to get people to commit time out of their busy schedules to come and help.
I know a big question is going to be, is there any food there?
At this time, I think there might be something to drink, but we're not planning on any kind of heavy refreshments.
Last year, when the budget started being questionable, people were waiting for the shoe to drop. When do you think that's going to happen?
Fortunately, you know, to date, it hasn't happened yet. And again, I think that the genesis of what we're all trying to figure out is with the state budget challenges and the significant loss of revenue, and currently they're still working through the process of how to balance the state budget. So there's been uncertainty around it. The Juneau economy has stayed stable. You know, we kind of measure our economy through jobs, through how much sales tax we collect, and those have been remarkably stable. We expect there to be some contraction, and our what can directly impact our budget kind of happens in two big ways. We get some direct state revenues to pay for school debt, to pay for education, and we can have a reduction in direct state revenue that gets appropriated to us. So that's one thing that happens at the state budget level. The second way we get impacted is, you know, the state's downsizing. There's fewer jobs than there used to be, and that ripples through the economy. And we see that when there's less sales tax or the values of property might start to adjust. So currently, we've been stable. But as we look out one fiscal year or two fiscal years, we're projecting that, you know, we're going to start seeing anywhere from a 2 to 4 or 5% decline in the economy. And again, fortunately, we've had other positives, tourism growth, stability in the mining sector that's kept the economy stable.
How are the meetings scheduled? Or structured, I should say.
Okay, so how they're structured is the first part is an education on the city budget. So we'll just walk you through at a high level. Where are we spending our money now? What programs and services, what departments spend how much money? That'll be the first part. The second part is we will explain the priority-driven budget process and what are the criteria we're asking you to use to evaluate the program. So we'll kind of give you a little education on the process. And then the final part will be actually sitting down with information on all the programs and services, and we'll tell you how much we spend, how many employees it takes to deliver it, roughly what is that program or service, and then we're going to ask you to tell us, is that a high priority, a medium priority, or a low priority service?
I'm talking with Bob Bartholomew now from the city. We're talking about the budget and how you can help out by becoming a volunteer. Bob, you want to talk about when those meetings are again, please?
Yes, I'll do one more. So, again, and it's on the website, www.juno.org. But the first focus group meeting to help us prioritize programs and services is for senior citizens, and that's Friday, February 3rd, 2 days from now, from 10 a.m. to 12 p.m. A Rotary and Chamber of Commerce group or joint focus group, Monday, February 6th at 1 p.m. at the Valley Library. General public session, Thursday, February 9th, 1 to 3 p.m. at the Valley Library. Families with kids in kindergarten through 8th grade, Saturday, February 11th, 10 a.m. to noon at the Valley Library. Another general public session, Thursday, February 16th, 6 to 8 p.m., Valley Library. And again, we need people that are interested to go to the website and to register, or you can call 586-5240 and register, and then you can get confirmation on which session you can participate in.
Well, Bartholomew, thanks a lot. Anything you'd like to add I might have forgotten to ask?
No. I just encourage folks that that there's going to be some hard decisions having to be made by the Assembly, and the more feedback we can get from the community and the public, the better decisions we can make.
Well, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Wednesday. It's the 1st of February, 2017. It's the birthday of Muriel Spark, born in Edinburgh in 1918, best known for coming-of-age novel The Prime of Miss Jean Brodie, came out in 1961, about a strong-willed teacher who selects six of her students to mentor as the creme de la creme of the Marcia Blaine School for Girls. It's the birthday of the poet who said, "To me, poetry is somebody standing up, so to speak, and saying with as little concealment as possible what it is for him or her to be on earth at this moment." Galway Connell, born in Providence, Rhode Island, 1927, went off to Princeton, studied abroad through the 1960s, came back to this country to join the Congress for Racial Equality, helping to register black voters in the segregated South. It's the birthday of S.J. Perlman, Brooklyn, 1904, wrote for the New Yorker magazine, sentences like, "The waiter's eyes sparkled and their pencils flew as she proceeded to eviscerate my wallet, pâté, Whitstable oysters, a sole, and a favorite salad of the Nizam of Hyderabad made of shredded 5-pound notes." S.J. Perlman, who was influenced by James Joyce and Flann O'Brien, was a big fan of P.G. Wodehouse, and who said he was preoccupied with clichés, Baroque language, and the elegant variation. And it's the birthday of Langston Hughes, born in Joplin, Missouri, 1902. Came to New York, worked as a busboy at a hotel in New York City, came out with his first volume of poetry, The Weary Blues, in 1926. Went to college briefly, worked as a seaman on ships and a waiter, a truck farmer, worked as a doorman at a nightclub in Paris. Became a prominent member of the Harlem Renaissance, along with Zora Neale Hurston and Count E. Cullen. Langston Hughes, asked what he wrote about, said workers and singers and job hunters on Lenox Avenue in New York, people up today and down tomorrow, working this week and fired the next, beaten and baffled but determined not to be wholly beaten, buying furniture on the installment plan, filling the house with rumors to help pay the rent, hoping to get a new suit for Easter, and pawning that suit before the 4th of July. Here's a poem for today by Edna St. Vincent Millay, Modern Declaration. "I, having loved ever since I was a child a few things, never having wavered in these affections, never through shyness in the houses of the rich or in the presence of clergymen having denied these loves, never when worked upon by cynics like chiropractors having grunted or clicked a vertebra to the discredit of these loves, never when anxious to land a job having diminished them by a conniving smile, or when befuddled by drink, jeered at them through heartache, or lazily fondled the fingers of their alert enemies, declare that I shall love you always, no matter what party is in power, no matter what temporarily expedient combination of allied interests wins the war, shall love you always. Modern Declaration, a poem by Edna St. Vincent Millay from her selected poems, published by Yale University Press and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation, publisher of Poetry Magazine, now available on iOS devices, subscriptions available at poetrymagazine.org. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Support comes from the Alaska Robotics Gallery, offering art that features narwhals, squid, and flying whales, located at 220 Front Street in downtown Juneau. More information at alaskarobotics.com.
So 21 minutes past the hour, and you are tuned into Juneau Afternoon. Our next guest in the studio here, Carmel Anderson, who's an artist from Ketchikan, Jackie Manning from the Alaska State Museum, and Brett Donison from Aware. Thank you so much for coming down to the station today.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
So you've got an art show at the Alaska State Museum.
Yes, it's incredibly exciting to see how it's all coming together, and just the community support so far has been just amazing.
The main focus of it is domestic violence.
Correct. Correct. It is on, I'm a painter, and I live in Ketchikan, Alaska, and my focus was always about women and the voice of women. And what I started to see over time was there were some women who were incredibly sages and wise. And I saw similar women who had similar past experiences who just had a lot of anger and just become my unmentors. But what I realized was a lot of them were carrying unhurt pain and unhealed wounds from years ago and had no opportunity for the healing. And the whole premise of my art is to live your own greatest story. And so I felt like this pain was blocking these women that I was studying to live their greatest story. And so from that, I expanded into doing work on sexual assault and domestic violence from some of the women that I've grown close to who carried that pain from that. And it's a very hard topic to understand and to explain to people. But what I like about art is it's a visual language, and it often reaches places deep with people or where logic thought can't. And so it is, I did it with great respect and beauty and aesthetic. And so I intentionally did not put faces because I did not want it to be a reminder of any person, because it's about the essence of the spirit and what happens to the person and their experiences. I also made the life-size sculptures are a stark white because, again, domestic violence and sexual assault affects all races, all skin colors, all incomes, and so I did not want it to be about that, but it's really about the experience and what the woman goes through.
Yeah, you call them figurative sculptures.
Correct. It's more of an installation work. People ask me how I make the pieces, and for me, it's really about the concept and what the message of the piece is. So I started out actually in New York City as a fashion designer for my career and did a lot of work there. But my passion was always more about the inner beauty of women than the outer beauty. And so my focus has been really on bringing beauty and wisdom and truth and really lifting up the wise women that we have and so much to learn from and so much beauty. So my work is an array of things that it's really more installation because I look at the concept and then I look at how to create it. So I started out as a painter after fashion, and then I also did sculpture, and now I've kind of grown into this installation work. And so you'll see a little bit of all my past careers and types of medium that I've used in the show.
Tell me about the Hope Quilt, please.
The Hope Quilt. Hope Quilt is very interesting, and the power of the art, I feel like the art has more power and wisdom than I do, or pretty much any person, because it brings it its own meaning, and the Hope Quilt is an excellent example of this. When I was putting the show together in Ketchikan a few years ago, we happened to be when the survey from the UA Justice Department came out, and given the statistics that Ketchikan, like so much of the state, had 50% of the women in our community have suffered violence. And it was a huge number, and it was amazing that the study came out short few months before my opening. So it came from, we couldn't say, oh, that's other communities. It was our community. And one of the advice I was given by some of the experts in the state is you have to have some hope, Carmel, or people just walk away from this heavy, traumatic topic feeling worse and overwhelmed. And so at the last minute, we had an open wall, and we didn't know what to do with the space. And myself and the gallery manager in Ketchikan just started talking about how we wanted wisdom, and we wanted hope, and we wanted the connectiveness, and the quilt came together because we are all connected, especially in Alaska, living in so many rural areas like Ketchikan and Juneau, where we really have to come together as a community in a stronger way, and how sexual assault and domestic violence affects all of our communities, not just the people that it directly affects. It permeates into our communities, and so I wanted that connectedness that we can't break from each other, and the response has been amazing. Britta did an amazing job here in Juneau getting them together, and it just is kind of an organic process where a lot of it's word of mouth or the advocates such as Britta really sharing about it, and then we have squares available for people to share their wisdom, and really it's their stories. So we have ones from children, we have a retired judge, we have grown men sharing that their memories from childhood of watching what happened to their mother. We have men, sharing what happened a little bit with them. So it's more their stories in the sense of what they learned and what they want to share. And really, the title of my show is Unheard Voices, Unheard Wisdom. So it's really about if we want to solve this epidemic, which is across Alaska, we really need to hear from those who survived it or those who are directly affected by it. And they have that wisdom. And that's what this quilt offers. And, people are greatly moved by reading it, and it adds a depth and an understanding that I think touches us deeply, especially because they're all Alaskan voices that are shared in the quilt.
You stress people should talk more about the subject matter rather than the material, but I'd like to ask you a few questions. It seems like there's gauze and
silk organza. Silk organza. So I found silk organza and fell in love with it because the quality of it and the crispness of it and the feel of it. So I bought a large bolt, and some of it I dyed, some of it I put into tea, some of it I've kind of ripped and pinned. And then I found a few other fabrics that were embroidered that you'd see in the child's piece called Marked, and actually the other child's piece, which is embroidered. And those are more synthetic fabric, but the silk organza is just an amazing fabric to work with.
I'm here in the studio with Carmel Anderson, Jackie Manning, and Britt Thomason. Jackie, you want to talk about the run of the show, please?
Yes, so Carmel's exhibit opens this Friday, and so it'll be open for First Friday, 4:30 to 7 p.m., but she's going to give an artist talk at 6 p.m. and walk through her exhibit. We have a lot of people have helped put this exhibit together. The Alaska Children's Trust has helped to bring Carmel here and is also helping with two workshops that are happening in association with her exhibit, as well as AWARE. AWARE has been helping us with this exhibit, with the workshops, and also with the Hope Quilt and getting the voices from Juneau. So the exhibit runs, again, this February 3rd, First Friday through March 18th, and the opening is free, and again, 6 o'clock, Carmel will be talking about her work in the gallery.
And it's going to Anchorage and beyond.
Correct. It goes next to Anchorage with an opening April 7th, and then to Sitka, and then the fall we'll be taking it to up in the tundra area and working out a few more details on that, but it will be traveling quite extensively. The other wonderful thing is we recently got a grant to help us with funds for materials and postage so that all the shelters we can contact to allow all those who have been affected directly to be a voice in the quilt if they so choose. So.
The color of the exhibit is pretty much a stark white. Why do you use that color?
I think there's a starkness to it. I mean, first of all, we talked about the skin color. I didn't want a skin color, so the pieces were white. The silk organza is just a beautiful fabric in and of itself. And so I wanted an elegance and a respect because I think the women and other people who are affected by this are adding a beauty. It's a dark topic, and I think people kind of expect it to be dark, and yet we bring it with a powerful message that still has the elegance, and in the beautiful, you know, new museum setting gallery, it's going to be stunning.
And this is our first solo artist to have an exhibit in the new museum, so we're pretty excited to have Carmel in there.
And Britta, what do you end up doing with Ware?
So Aware was linked to this project through the State Libraries and Archives Museum, and I think specifically through Jackie, which was really wonderful. She mentioned that Carmel would be coming up and asked if we wanted to collaborate. And so Aware has kind of helped collaborate. Well, I guess I'll start with part of my job is to reach out to the community and to receive people who are reaching back to us or reaching towards us. And Carmel, with the Children's Alaska Trust and the SLAM, offered to put together a workshop, a couple workshops, and one is a workshop tonight for advocates, and it's called My Mask, My Meaning, and I'll probably not be as eloquent as Carmel, but the inside of the mask will express what we feel on the inside, and the outside will be what we express on the outside. And then there's another workshop that has been funded through the Alaska Children's Trust. Lunch will be provided for teenagers who have maybe lived through domestic violence and sexual assault, and they'll be doing a similar project with Aware and Carmel. And so we've just been kind of helping to do the outreach for that and support Carmel and the SLAM in this project.
And then the masks will go on display. We'll probably get them up next week, and they'll go in the mezzanine cases, in one of those mezzanine cases in the atrium of the Andrew P. Kashubiroff building.
So session with Aware is tonight at 6 o'clock.
6 at the Canvas, and it's for advocates, so community advocates, I would say, could come and be part of it. We still have some spaces available for people to join us.
And when does it open at the museum?
The exhibit opens on Friday at 4:30, and that opening will be until 7, and Carmel will give her artist talk at 6 p.m.
Carmel, thanks for coming down to the station today.
Thank you.
music of Michael Hedges. It's 34 minutes past the hour. You are tuned to it in the afternoon. Our next guest on the phone is Sue Pearls from Anchorage. She's going to talk about all things Girl Scouts. Sue, thanks for being on the air with me today.
Thank you so much for having me on, and hi to all the Girl Scouts out there.
So you've got cookies coming up and also an auction.
We have cookies coming up. Girls are out and about in the Juneau area now with what we call order cards, taking orders. Cookies will be here in early February, so they can deliver their orders, or you'll see the girls out at grocery stores and sporting goods stores selling cookies.
About how many Girl Scouts are there in Alaska?
Well, we have between 5,000 and 6,000 girls in our council, and then we have a sister council up in Fairbanks.
Wow. What's the most exciting things that the girls do?
Well, everything girls do in Girl Scouts is exciting. This summer, we have what we call encampment, where we take over the fairgrounds in Palmer and have girls from all across the state, and some years girls from all around the world meet in the Palmer fairgrounds and do 3 days of fun workshops and hands-on programming. They learn about arts and culture, about science, about new sports, have a great time. There are inspirational speakers. They make new friends and just have a fantastic time. And that's going to happen this June.
Where is that happening?
That'll be in the Palmer Fairgrounds in early June. We also will have several weeks of summer camp in Juneau. And that's still to be scheduled, but that's probably going to be in right around either just before or just after the 4th of July. And we always have lots of girls at summer camp. We run a Women of Science and Technology Day over at University of Alaska Southeast, and that's a fun activity for girls to participate in, and have lots of other things going on. Juneau Girl Scouts have two robotics teams, and they compete statewide and have a ball, and there's just lots of different ways you can be a Girl Scout.
About how many boxes of cookies do you sell a year?
Oh, that's a great question. We sell hundreds of thousands of boxes of cookies every year. And our most popular cookie, because that's usually the next question, our most popular cookie is the Samoa, which is the chocolate coconut caramel cookie, although nationally the most popular cookie is the Thin Mint.
Well, what do you know?
We also have on Saturday evening, February 25, our annual auction at the Jack in Juneau, and that's open to the public. There's lots of terrific auction items that'll be available. A nice dinner, and if you want dessert, you've got to buy a cake.
Cool. And again, that is happening there towards the end of the month?
That's February 25.
All right. Well, thanks so much for being on the phone with me, Sue.
I appreciate your inviting me.
Have a good time.
Thank you. And if there's anyone out there who would like to be a Girl Scout troop leader or a Girl Scout, just hop on our website, GirlScoutsAlaska.org, and click on the appropriate buttons. We'd be happy to have you join us.
Thanks, Sue.
Thank you, sir.
It's 39 minutes past here, and you are tuned into Juneau Afternoon. Our next guest is Greg Chaney.
Hello.
Who is here to talk about his film.
Yeah, I just thanks, Jeff, for having me on. It's always great to be here. And I just wanted to check in really fast and say we're having a showing of the romantic comedy that I made this summer called 1.5 Days. It's all local crew, and we had one person come in from Los Angeles Screen Actor Guild actress to be the lead, but the lead guy is from Juneau, Brian Crowder. We have several other locals in there, and we also everyone behind the camera was local. So it's kind of an exciting thing to get off the ground. And I wanted to mention before I say anything else that it was scheduled at the Goldtown, but the Goldtown's projector broke. So we're in Centennial Hall. So Centennial Hall, 7 p.m. tonight.
That's cool. What do you learn most of all that next time you do a film?
Well, it's a very exciting process because you're collaborating with so many people and you're trying to use everybody's skills together. And then you've got the details of sound, audio quality. The cameras are changing so fast. Each time you start a project, you really have to learn the camera again because it's different than it used to be. And now it's all a digital world, so that's different than the film world that a lot of people started in.
And rather than using a single camera, you had multiple cameras.
Yeah. We use a unique technique where we had, three people filming the actors at all times or most of the time. And that way you can cut between different angles really fast. You don't have to reshoot the whole scene for a different angle. And it's much more efficient. It's much more natural. And it's something we can do today with the digital technology because we're not spending hundreds of dollars per minute on film. The actual storage is cheap. Still, running three cameras is a trick. You know, you've got to have everybody coordinated. People are actually walking backwards where the actors are walking forwards. Your sound person's walking backwards. And so you have to have someone watching behind, make sure that no one's going to trip. So, yeah, it was an innovative challenge.
Did you write all the scripts before you started shooting, or were there a lot of changes going on?
No, we wrote the script. I wrote the script with some help of some other folks. But we didn't change the script a lot. I gave the actors pretty free opportunity to ad-lib within their lines. But what they did was they might change the way a sentence was stated, but they wouldn't change what the sentence contained. So they would say it in their own words sometimes and better than I could write it because I don't want to write somebody's voice for them necessarily. But, primarily we stuck with the script. We ended up cutting some stuff at the end during the edit. You kind of look and go, oh, that didn't work as well as I'd hoped. So, it's not exactly what the script was that we started with, but it's pretty close. I'd say it's about 80 to 90%.
How long is the film?
It's 1 hour and 5 minutes.
And it's called One and a Half?
1.5 Days. It's a story. It's a romantic comedy. It's got a formula. You've got boy meets girl kind of thing. But, she's got some things that she's trying to work through, and he's got some confidence issues, and they kind of help each other out. And, you have to watch the movie, but it's got a classic plot line, but an unexpected twist.
And it shows tonight at the Centennial Hall.
Yes. And it's filmed in Juneau, so you've got cruise ships, bears, the whole nine yards.
And how much does it cost to get in?
Okay, well, we're going to be asking for donations. So I had to move to Centennial Hall, so that's actually a very expensive thing to do at last minute. But, we're asking for about a $10 donation, but it's optional, whatever people can afford.
What's your next film? Hey, you got it ready yet?
I'm thinking about it, but it's going to be a while. I've got to recover from this. My wife's got to recover from this. My marriage has to recover from this. All right.
Thanks a lot, Greg.
Hey, it was great to be on.
This is Bird Note. The American kestrel. Small, numerous, and widespread. Watch for one of these North American falcons perched on a utility wire, bobbing its tail. True to the name falcon, this species is built for speed, with long pointed wings, often bent back at the tip. If a suitable perch isn't available, American kestrels will hover above an open field. Facing into the wind, they flap their wings and use their tails to hold their position. From aloft, kestrels watch for insects, small mammals, and reptiles, which they overtake and capture. Don't be fooled by their small size, equal to that of a robin. These are fierce hunters. Using their notched beaks, kestrels quickly subdue their prey by severing the spinal cord at the neck. The lack of suitable nesting cavities limits kestrel populations in some areas, and this has led people to install wooden nest boxes. Many states now have Kestrel Nest Box programs, placing boxes along interstate highways. On I-35 in Iowa, there's a Kestrel box nearly every mile from Minnesota to Missouri. The Kestrels readily adapt to these boxes and return each spring to set up housekeeping. You can find out more about Kestrels, including photos and plans for a nest box, on our website, birdnote.org. I'm Michael Stein.
When 17-year-old Nick takes a float plane to his grandparents' village, it signals change for his grandfather, cousin, father, and his grandmother, Linda, the strong warp in this family whose experiences are woven together with modern and traditional storytelling, including song, dance, poetry, and 90s hip-hop. A world premiere portrait of an Alaskan family by Thlinget playwright Frank Henry Koshkatas. They Don't Talk Back runs January 25th through February 19th at Perseverance Theater. Tickets at the Jack, Hearthside Books, ptalaska.org, and 463-TIXS.
It's about 15 minutes before the hour, and you're tuned into June Afternoon. Our next guests are here to talk about animals as part of the Wednesday Wildlife Series. Patricia Weary, thanks for coming down to the station, and Steve Brockman, thank you for coming down also.
Thank you.
Thanks. Good to be here.
It starts at 7 o'clock and goes till 8 o'clock tonight?
Yes.
In the Valley Library?
At the Valley Library.
And it's on eagles, otters, and wolves. How did you choose to group those animals together?
Well, eagles, otters, and wolves are three of the really charismatic species that there are strong federal interest in Southeast Alaska. It keeps U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service kind of emblematic of the work we do here. Only three small examples, really, though, of the really broad variety of stuff that the Fish and Wildlife Service is engaged in. And tonight I'll be sharing with folks the variety of stuff that the Fish and Wildlife Service has worked on in the years that we've been here, and some of the things that are currently taking up our time. And those three species are just three examples that you'll hear about.
What's your favorite animal?
My favorite animal? I'm not sure I have a favorite animal. Favorite animal. I don't know. You got to love deer.
What about eagles and otters and wolves?
So the one of the things that those three all have in common is a federal interest or a federal nexus. In the case of otters, the Marine Mammal Protection Act is a federal law that Congress passed to protect marine mammals, and it puts Fish and Wildlife Service in charge of three of them in Alaska. Sea otters is one of them that we have here in Southeast. In the case of eagles, it is the national symbol, but Congress stepped in 1940 over concerns that their populations were declining and said, we have a federal interest in protecting this bird, and they assigned the Department of Interior and Fish and Wildlife Service with some responsibilities there. So we've got a lot of eagles in Southeast Alaska, and we've got a long history of working with eagles here. And in the case of wolves, it's a state-managed species, but there was there have been a series, really, of recent petitions to list the species as an endangered species under the Endangered Species Act, again, a federal act. And where there's a federal act that names a species or gives the Fish and Wildlife or some other federal agency responsibility and authority, then we step up and we've got an interest. And in all three of those cases, Congress has spoken, and in the case of the wolf, the public has petitioned us under the laws of the federal government, and so they have a federal interest now.
I had a rumor that there are wolves on Douglas Island.
Oh, I think it's more than a rumor. Now, there was a trapper got, I want to say, we're getting a little outside of my area here. We're talking about state management now of a fur bearer and a game animal, but they did, I want to say, seven of them a few years ago, and just recently I heard somebody got a few more, one or two or three, something like that. I'm not the authority on that one, though.
Tell me something about otters that most people don't know.
Well, sea otters, a lot of people report that they see sea otters on the beaches running around Juneau or maybe crossing a road in the springtime. They're active and running around. Those are not sea otters. Those are river otters. What you see
in Juneau and a lot of the inside waters here are river otters. There have been occasional sightings of sea otters. The closest I've seen them is Eldred Rock, just across Lynn Canal. Although I have heard reports, credible reports from people who know what they look like, that sea otters have been spotted near the Ted Stevens Marine Research Facility out at Lena. That's an interesting observation, and I believe the person who told it to me. So then they're apparently moving in. They're otherwise, for the last 50 years, have been restricted to the outside coast in southeast Alaska.
What are you talking about tonight?
Well, tonight's topic really is the work of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service in southeast. We'll talk a little bit about how we got here, how long we've been here, and some of the work of the giants that did so many important things in the early history of Alaska, even before statehood and after.
Such as what?
We did some groundbreaking work, really, on developing aerial survey techniques for waterfowl, aerial survey techniques for bald eagles, bald eagle nests. We documented some real important things that allowed us to escape having to list species up here that are listed down south or have been in the past. The eagle is one example of that. We developed some techniques for trapping eagles and really some interesting stuff. And more you'll hear about tonight.
It starts at 7 o'clock and goes to 8 o'clock. Mm-hmm. Patricia, you want to tell us what's up next?
Well, it's our last one. And when people look at our charts, it was going to be on bears, on brown bears. But that person is not available, so we've got to switch. And Doug Jones is going to be talking about whales.
And that's the first Wednesday of next month?
Right.
All right. Anything like that I might have forgotten to ask?
Nope. We appreciate being able to come to Juneau Afternoons.
Appreciate having you here.
Alaskan can make a difference when they file online for their PFD. Pick, click, give. A great and easy way to support nonprofits in Alaska. You simply donate during your PFD application process. There are dozens of nonprofits that you can support in Juneau alone, including KTOO Public Media. The application period for the PFD begins January 1st and runs through March 31st. More information can be found at pickclickgive.org.
It's 5 minutes before the hour, and you're tuned into Juneau Afternoon. Our next guest is Jeff McLeod, here to talk about Eagle Crest, and it's still winter up there.
It is still winter up there, Jeff. I know that the last couple of weeks the weather's been a little bit challenging, and I've had a lot of people go, well, does Eagle Crest still have snow up there? And I'm here to say, yes, there's still snow. The snow is good. I skied on Monday and was quite pleased with the turns that I made. So just reminding everyone that winter is still here, and keep thinking about Eagle Crest.
What are the hours?
So we are now starting to chase daylight a little bit. So starting right now, our lifts are operating 9 to 3:30. Starting on Saturday, the lower mountain lifts, which is the Hooter chair and the Porcupine chair, will be open from 9 to 4, and then the upper chair lifts will be open. Ptarmigan is open 9 to 3:30, and then weekends and holidays, Black Bear is still open 9:30 to 3:30. But days are getting longer, and so the lifts are starting to stay open a little bit later.
My favorite time is spring break.
Yep, and spring break is coming up. It's hard to believe that we're now in February. Tomorrow's Groundhog Day, so I guess we'll see what the groundhog has to say about winter. But we know there's still at least six more weeks of winter up at Eagle Crest. So we're looking forward to long days and lots of snow coming up. If you haven't learned how to ski or snowboard yet this year and that was on your bucket list for the season, you can still take a lesson. We have plenty of snow and good skiing and lots of instructors out there to get you going up on a new winter sport.
Jeffrey Kahn, if people want to have questions about Eagle Crest, how can they find us?
They can find us on our website at skijuno.com. It's got everything all about Eagle Crest on there. They can also find us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and Snapchat.
Jeffrey, thank you for coming by.
Thanks for having me, Jeff.
There's a high wind watch in effect from Thursday afternoon through Saturday afternoon. Strong northerly outflow expected to develop Thursday into what seems like it might be Taku winds. Forecast for tonight, mostly cloudy skies, low temperatures around 15 degrees. Thursday, clear skies, high temperatures around 30. Thursday night, clear skies. Friday, clear skies again. And Friday night, clear skies, according to the National Weather Service. Coming up tomorrow in June afternoon, June Partis will be your host. She'll talk with Alaska's writer laureate, Ernestine Hayes. We'll learn about Razor Clams with Kate O'Brien. Jeff Staff, featured artist at the Juno Artist Gallery, will be here to highlight her art. And Nancy Cherney will be here with art news during Arts Up. That Writer's Almanac, we're known more Thursday on Juno Afternoon.